So if the AI doesn't do what you want it to do, for an artist, that's a poetic moment. It's like, oh, this is interesting. Why is this happening? Let's work with this. The companies are more like, oh, like, how can we shut this down?
Hello and welcome to the Culture and Technology Podcast. My name is Severin Matusek and today's guest is Mercedes Bunz. Mercedes is Professor of Digital Culture and Society at King's College London, where we are right now. And her research explores how digital technology transforms areas such as knowledge, communication, power, and society.
Correct.
Correct. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to be here, and I would love to start the conversation talking about a revolution, the Silent Revolution, which is the book that you published in 2012, which I find was quite early in the topics it tackles, such as how algorithms shape society and work and knowledge and so on. I'm curious about your take on how have your thesis on these topics developed since 2012? Along with a changing world, of course. It's a big question, but maybe we start with the publishing of the book and how that came to be.
Yeah, I think massively, a lot has changed, of course. And on the other hand, it hasn't, which is always like this kind of weird thing.
And I'd love to talk about that, because I also feel it hasn't changed.
So I think I wrote the book when social media was just sort of big, right? I think 2007 is a really important year with the iPhone coming out. Facebook has come out, I think, 2004, roughly all about this time. I would have to Google it to really be 100% sure. But a lot had changed. And in the beginning, around 2012, people were also still quite excited about the democratic possibilities of social media and so on and so on. And of course, that has sort of turned quite a bit. But we also had different technology in the meantime. Apps have become really important. The fact that the internet left a computer and is on a phone is really a very big step. It's still the second silent revolution, so to speak. And well, now we're going into the age of AI. And I think what I find quite interesting is if you look at sorting algorithms, social media platforms, Web 2.0, all of that before, they all sort of solved problems that people had. It's like, do I stay connected with my friends? Can I have my own little public sphere with my friends? Can I also have a public sphere? Can I blog or can I, post somewhere? And these were all like problems, or can I, check my email, not just on my computer? These were all convenient things. AI is a bit different because it's not directly, it doesn't tackle a solution or a need. It's a solution in, it's searching for a problem. And it doesn't solve a problem that we have, because all of us could write and all of us could think and some of us could draw and illustrate, but there wasn't this big need that the whole world needs. I don't know, crocodiles that are a bombing plane at the same, I'm thinking of Italian brain rot.
Yeah,
very known.
Bombardillo Crocodilo.
Yes, exactly, AI slob fun that my students enjoy very much. So I think there's a slight difference. And what surprises me is that people sort of quite jump onto it, companies jump onto it, all the corporations put a lot of money in there. States treat Sam Altman as if he would be an ambassador of a country. And it's quite interesting that on the ground it hasn't found a tracking. It pops up everywhere, but the usage is not 100% clear yet. But at the same time, it's sort of seen as this magic, mighty, powerful future. And that's a bit different, I think, from the early internet, where it was completely clear that digitizing data sets or that were on paper before would be more efficient.
Yeah. But I would argue that AI, in the way it's being presented to us right now, through AI agents such as ChatGPT, Claude, etc., it makes the processing of this massive amounts of data that we've put online in the last 20 or 30 years a lot faster and in certain ways a lot smarter and connected in a way. So it almost seems to me like it's a solution to a problem that we created ourselves by creating all this content and data online.
Yeah. As an academic, I work a lot with things that are published. And it's, we can't read everything that has been published.
Yeah.
And to that extent, you're right. I mean, you could call it a solution. It can synthesize, summarize. You can't be 100% certain, but it sort of works more or less.
So, yeah.
I mean, we also, I think, make the mistake that we pretend all of a sudden that society before AI functioned according to absolute 100% correctness, no mistakes made. But to be honest, society functions a lot without very precise knowledge. There's a nice German term for it, gefährliches Halbwissen, which is quite nice. But I think now we're sort of seeing, oh God, there's this, you know, the alternative facts is now the new reality. We always lived a bit with that and negotiated with that. But now it's sort of, we start to understand which are the areas where we have to have a second look and make really sure things are correct. And where is it fine to just roughly know this is how it works?
I'd also say in that context that I feel like what's going on right now with how many people feel about AI is that there's this dichotomy between extreme hype and optimization and optimism. And fear that AI is going to take away what's truly human, what makes us human, and so on. So I think out of this fear and out of the almost philosophical need to distinguish ourselves from the machine creation, we look at AI and point down to its failures. That this is wrong, and this is wrong, and this is not perfect, and this is not, this will never reach the levels of human-made art. So it's sort of like a coping mechanism, I think, of humans in relationship to the machine.
Yeah, you're right. I think you point to two very interesting things. One is that we humans have a real problem to deal with technology in a balanced way. Like we always need to see it as a savior or as the devil. And to find something in between seems to be really hard. I need to find time to research really where this is coming from because it's really sort of seems to be nearly religious, right?
Yeah.
Whether you buy in or you hate it. It sort of has a lot to do with belief instead of a reasonable, rational understanding. And yeah, and I think from that, it's also this sort of weird fear that we have. And it's quite funny because, I mean, as humans, we deal with a lot of things that are better than us. I mean, horses run faster than we do. Most animals can do something we can't do. And we're not standing there and going like, oh my God, that's not really... And then we have all of a sudden this fear of where is the line and where is really our original part. And in my work and also in the work that we do in the Creative AI Lab, it's quite important that we say we always have been humans with technology. And, you know, if you watch little babies just being born or even before still in the womb, they suck their thumb. It's sort of their first technology is really to, soothe yourself down. And this kind of usage is sort of very interesting to see technology not as the other or not as something that threatens you, but as something that was always part of being human, using tools, writing things on a piece of paper because, you know, to make sure everything's said or asked and so on. I think this is nothing new, but we were always a bit worried at the same time about technology.
Yeah, there's a whole economic aspect through it by all these hyper-funded companies that, of course, want people to believe a certain narrative that puts them into a powerful position, and they're not interested so much in demystifying their technology. So do you feel like by demystifying how, for example, large language models work and really bringing it down to like a level of this has always been part of being human, essentially, it helps people shape their perspective in a different way or helps people have more agency in relationship to these technologies?
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it. There are these different narratives out there. And I mean, we already in the short time that we live with AI, which is like probably, it became really big around 2014 when in image recognition, it made a big step with ImageNet and AlexNet and 2012, 2014. And now again with ChatGPT 2022, of course. Mm-hmm. But through the last years, we've already seen one big shift from the AI safety doom debate to, oh no, that debate's not on anymore. And that, of course, has a lot to do with the political framing of the Trump government that sort of said, we don't want to have the AI doom debate. Mm. Before, economy was really interested in having that doom aspect because, you know, it makes you important. You are working on something, you are keeping check on something that could end humanity. So it makes you very valuable. So the narrative is very much sort of framed in this weird way. And my role is to translate it, it's also to explain it. I think computer scientists rightly talk to other computer scientists with like very special terms, from embedding, reinforcement learning with human feedback to, you know, vector spaces and so on and so on. And what does it actually mean? How does it actually work? Can you translate this into a language everyone can understand? Mm-hmm. It's a bit of a role, because I think everyone needs to know, probably, I don't think everyone needs to create AI, but everyone needs to know about the mechanisms. And that's a bit my role, or also the role of my colleagues, mm-hmm. I think. Mm-hmm. And then it's also just like a weird thing, you know, like we're like excited little puppies all going like, oh, no one really knows 100% how that works. So we're all like, what the hell is going on? Mm. Why can we calculate meaning? How can we calculate language? This is exciting.
I love that when researching your biography and how to introduce you, I think several times it was mentioned, this interest in digital technology and its impact on society is, of course, a never-ending stream of new things that gives always new angles to the research part, which I think you beautifully described now.
Yeah.
I want to go back to what you mentioned about the Trump administration and the change of narratives, because I think that brings in a very important element that is also often overlooked, which I think is the role of power structures and geopolitics in a certain way when it comes to technologies.
Yeah.
I'm curious, would you say that, when it comes to the debate around AI in general, where I think there's now this arms race between China and the US, and it gets a lot about global domination and, you know, not even AI as an interface for end users like us, but AI as an interface for weapons, for example. And then there is the European perspective, at least the one that I often read, which is more around regulation, care, caution. Do these perspectives play into your work and your research as well? And what do you think about it?
Yeah, I think they do. I actually do a lot of work with policy making in the UK, which is quite wild. We have not just one EU AI Act, but a lot of institutions. And then at the same time, it seems too many, you know. So every one of us who researches AI studies the EU AI Act. We look at how the US is dealing with it. China has several regulations out now. Interestingly, one of them is you can only train on copyright material.
Uh-huh. So interesting. Okay.
Yeah, uh-huh. It's very different because so far the US and the EU are much more open. Mm-hmm. As long as you acquired it legally, it doesn't matter if it's copy, you know, if you ask for copyright permission or not. But I think at the same time, yeah. So this is all quite interesting how it has been framed and what is going on. And you can also see the slight shift, how the technological development sort of overruled the regulation, or sort of, I mean, the EU AI Act, for example, was actually originally basically about automatic decision making. Then ChatGPT came out and really arrived in 2023. By that time, the EU AI Act was largely written.
Mm-hmm.
So, the EU AI struggled for a long time. Where do we put generative AI? Uh-huh. And this is not, our regulation doesn't tackle that. And then they just thought like, oh yeah, we have this pyramid, the safety pyramid, like on top, we have the really high risk. And then we go towards low risk. Maybe on the bottom, we put generative AI as its own category. It doesn't fit in the pyramid at all, right? Uh-huh. It's just like, okay, we don't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
So it does play a role. And I think it also frames the conversation and concept we have of a technology very much. So, yeah.
But that's a great example, I think, because it, I think in my understanding, shows how regulation often just lags behind innovation in a certain sense. So I think if I was a person who wrote this EU AI, AI Act or a policy maker in the European Union Parliament, I might be, you know, sleeping well because I might be thinking, oh, I did a good job. We produced a very smart document. But at the same time, 800 million users use ChatGPT every day and nobody uses European technology. Do you think that's a problem or that's a challenge that could somehow be solved?
I think it's a very big problem. I think the bigger problem is even that, you know, there's absolutely enough a Google paper out there that's called, I think it's from 2020 or 2022. Everyone wants to do the model work. No one wants to do the data work. I think it's a problem that so far most of the development is led from the US and now from China. Mm-hmm. Who've done really good work with models like Qwen, for example, and of course DeepSeek, that are open source, absurdly enough, while the US is very, you know, like we don't share our weights, we don't share anything. Mm-hmm. But I think there are some companies in Europe that are worth a second look, and I think they are, and not just Mistral, you know, there are several, and I think they're a bit overlooked. There's also a push in Germany for sort of what we call public AI, particularly from countries like Scandinavia or countries with smaller languages who said, like, you know, we need our own large language model. So these are all interesting developments. And I think in the future, we also see smaller models coming out that are more efficient, don't use so much energy. But one thing that will always be the case is that we need data. So for training a model, you need data. For reinforcement learning later on, fine-tuning an existing model, you need data. And I'm quite surprised that, you know, I think we're totally unprepared to change our narrative and view a little bit because we're still in the privacy narrative. Everyone's like about data. It's like, oh, don't take my data. I want to have my data with me. I don't want to share it. If we really want a public AI and we think AI is a solution for something, and you described it really well, it's like, you know, we can find things, we can connect things we couldn't connect before. It will remain a really important foundational technology. Why don't we have public data sets that are tested for bias, that are tested for, you know, extreme views or not, and that we give to researchers or small companies to stay a bit more in the competitive environment we are in. And I don't understand why that sort of aspect of data, because it hurts, it's really messy, it's difficult. You have to, you know, move a whole discourse towards, the people need to understand that giving their data could help medical diagnosis, could help saving water, electricity, you know, natural environments, biological understanding, all of that. And this discussion is sort of, no one wants to have that because I think it's really difficult to move this around.
I think that opens the door to a discussion we plan to have, which is how do large language models work anyway? Because I think, as you mentioned, as we prepare this conversation, when we talk about AI, we can talk about a million different things. And basically, I talk about one thing and you talk about the other. And I think it's very important to share how these models work as a way of demystifying them and understanding them. And then, talking about the data part that you just mentioned, because maybe we start there. It starts with the data, right? It starts with the data and the model is being taught by the data. And in the biggest data sets that we see, such as the ones that I think ChatGPT works with, basically the internet was scraped over the last 5 or 10 years for data that was being uploaded. No one was asked for consent. So an article you wrote 5 years ago is probably in there, an image we uploaded, etc., etc. And of course, millions of other data sets. So we have that on one side, I think, the public data that ChatGPT and other interfaces just took and now use as a continuous training set. And then you have the other option that you describe, which is a more deliberate approach to collecting data using consent by people using certain regulation or checking mechanisms to make sure there are no built-in biases, which I think we should also talk about what these biases are. Mm. So just to set the scene of the whole, like, how do LLMs work and how do they use data? Maybe you can expand on that.
Yeah, so I think basically what I find really fascinating is that LLMs use language and they change the documents. Billions of documents we scrape mm-hmm. from the internet, but also books, you know, like we write for centuries and we take all the novels, everything that's written in the past, everything that we can find. And then this is fed to a machine learning system. And that does a really banal program. It looks like what three words are next to before this word and behind this word. And then it moves from word to word over each single document, each single sentence, and goes through it. Mm-hmm. It's a work no one of us would do because it's just recognizing our three words before are these three and behind are these three. Mm-hmm. Because computers can, you know, save things really quickly, they can do that. Mm-hmm. Before that, of course, all the words are translated in numbers, so-called tokens. So mm-hmm. the computer actually never deals with words. They always deal with numbers. And that's something that's actually quite surprising. Only in the end for us, it's retranslated okay. to numbers, to words from numbers again, mm-hmm. so we can read it. Internally, it learns to understand then how to continue a sentence. So that's the so-called prediction that we mm-hmm. have so often. And what I really find interesting is like, the mathematical equations in a machine learning system are really mad. It's like really complex. They can be about syntax, about style, about which words belong together. And they're all in this what we call vector space. And mm-hmm. we have understood that things that are similar, like cat and dog, are mm-hmm. in the same space, while other stuff, house, tower, is in a different space. Mm-hmm. So the machine learns mathematically to put these all in and sort them somehow. And sometimes it makes a sorting mistake. And then the so-called hallucinations come out. Mm-hmm. Because when reading all the documents, the machine can tell you what word should come after that word, most likely. But it can't tell you if the sentences it produces are fact or fiction. It has no mathematical... it can't do that.
Yeah.
So that's quite something that I really love to dive deep in and probably talk too long about. Because I think it's quite important to understand, also to understand how do they make mistakes? Where do I need to look for, you know? Then the second thing is they need data. Mm-hmm. To train, we all need data. In the beginning, that was sort of a really gray area. As you rightly said, you know, companies sent out web crawlers and crawled the whole internet and then fed it back to the machine learning mm-hmm. system. Then everyone started waking up. It's like, no, not my data. Google was angry that OpenAI took YouTube data. Other people were angry that they took other data. Mm-hmm. And then weird things start to happen. So what we can see now is first that those web crawlers actually cause a lot of traffic. So there are a lot of web crawling out mm. there. We have also the weird effect that data sets that were originally before machine learning created, because in the past, those huge data sets could only be created by really big companies, Google, for example. Mm. So there were these data sets like Book 3 or Lion 5B mm-hmm. That are it's an image data set that were created for research. It was created originally to be nice, you know, mm-hmm. to allow small researchers mm-hmm. and small companies also to work with mm-hmm. stuff. And now a backfiring or sort of the situation got quite messy because now it's like, I don't want to be in these data sets, a lot of people say. So there is something we can, you know, it's like you have a door on the internet and you can put a little pixel in your web page,
uh-huh. yeah.
the robot.txt, mm-hmm. and say, crawler, you stay outside. Now, what happens and what we can see now, and that's a bit worrying about democracy, mm. is that the web becomes more and more narrow because people want to keep the crawlers out. And we see that misleading information, all those fake news, they don't care if the crawlers come. Mm. They are like, come in, crawl me. So actually the open web becomes totally distorted. Mm. What is open is fake and all the right stuff is behind closed doors. Mm. And I'm not sure if this is an information environment how we want it in the future. So, yeah.
So how could models or concepts like public AI counter that? Is there a way we can reverse this with a more democratic, mindful solution or approach to that?
Yeah, I think, you know, if you had a public push to say we want public AI, we want a public AI that's probably across nations, we want something where everyone profits from, this is a non-commercial endeavor, then people would, and can you give us your data? Would you be willing? And people would say, yeah, you know, we see in medicine that a lot of times people are very willing to share their data when it is about medical research. Mm. So I think it's also about, you know, there are a lot of people out there that understand that information is really important for knowledge. And so that's, I think, an important point. But we need to, at the moment, we have no vessel where to put my data. You know, I could say tomorrow, here, you can have my laptop. Mm-hmm. You can have all my data. Mm-hmm. But where to put it? Yeah. You know, no one wants it. Mm-hmm. So the first thing we do at the moment is we have the so-called opt-out measurement. So that's what the direction the EU is going in to say, people are allowed to train on your data, but you are also allowed to say, no, I want to opt out of the training. Mm. So you can search for your name or for your work. We're going to have that also for deep fakes, I think. You can search for your face and say, this kind of publications should not be public. This is my face and shouldn't be used anywhere else. But the next step, of course, we're not just to take it out, but also to give it somewhere, and that would then be really public AI. Mm-hmm.
Could we imagine that's maybe similar to Wikipedia 20 years ago? I remember, I would say there was a pre-Wikipedia time on the internet where, anyone could publish anything, which you can still today, but you never knew if something was correct or not. So it was kind of frowned upon also in academia to cite sources from the internet. Then Wikipedia came, and then I think there was this middle period where, people kind of semi-trusted it, but there was still a little bit of distance. And I think by now, because of the mechanisms that Wikipedia put in with its community, and there's probably still some flaws, but like a lot of Wikipedia pages, I think, probably reflect a general sense of facts in a way. Maybe I'm wrong. Yeah. You tell me.
No, I think that's correct.
But could we imagine a Wikipedia in the AI age, as in an interface, a model that's based on data and that's basically fact-checked and that's there by consent, and that's just either a website or maybe an alternative internet. Maybe the internet we've known so far is kind of becoming this open, weird, skewed universe that you described, and that's fine, but maybe we can build in the ruins of that a different internet based on the learnings we had so far. Do you think that might be a future that's coming?
Yeah, I mean, I would hope so. Mm. And I think, you know, if we would do one big foundational model and then do small data sets on top to do, you know, just because you can adapt models in very precise ways if you, in the end, train it on very specific data. So I think it would be a real chance if you have in one public data model that, you know, would serve our governments and so on, so on, so on. In principle, yeah, I mean, there's a question in which direction are we going at the moment, and I'm a bit worried that I see a bit too much belief in this is models are only done by corporations and they're not done in any other way. And I think that's just, you know, not thinking things through. I mean, you can see that also very different from where the internet started. We have a nationalization of the internet massively. Mm-hmm. We not just have all of a sudden terrorists in the world. Mm-hmm. We also have like these borders. The EU rightly said all the data should be in our data centers on the EU ground and not going, you know, not be in a country where we have no jurisdiction. But at the same time, if we buy in AI models from other nations, and is the question, I mean, the EU talks a lot about tech sovereignty. I don't know. I mean, I understand where the fear is coming from, because you never know, is there a backdoor or is there not a backdoor, what's going on? And language has a lot to do with ideology, and you don't know what's baked into something, even though, yeah. I'm a bit worried about if it's just, you know, if we just nationalize everything and every little country has its own little model. So yeah. I think a big push from all the countries together to create a shared core model and then share it. But it's open source in the real way. It's like we know the data that went in. We know the weights. We publish about it. Everyone can take it. I think that would be quite good.
I mean, I'd say one of the things that I observe is that unions like the European Union or countries still believe, if you're into politics, that they make the laws. And they do, of course, on the ground that they're situated in. I think the reality is that our minds and hearts are already in the cloud beyond national borders. So it's not up to the countries really anymore to decide what we as citizens of a country should be doing, because we're elsewhere already. And I think we will find ways to use what's already been there or is there, no matter if it comes from China or the US or Europe. We use whatever is useful or entertaining or fun, and we don't really care where it comes from.
Yeah, that's true. But then we're also really convenient and we're lazy.
Yes, which we are mostly.
Yeah, it's a typical human trait to be quite lazy. And that means, you know, I mean, the amount in which language is actually a border and also your IP address, you know, first of all, tells you, okay, I'll give you stuff in this language. The IP address and the language that you're using is really regional and sort of slots you into this kind of thing. And it functions like a certain border. We've now understood that, okay, we can use VPNs and stuff to sort of try to see what other countries give us. But it's really, I mean, you know, I'm not using the Russian search engine and I'm not using Baidu or, you know, Chinese.
Right.
But it's actually not true. Sometimes we do use it because we teach international internet. But, but I think people... The idea that people always had is like, oh, and my fingertips is the World Wide Web. The web was never worldwide.
Yeah.
It wasn't already in the 1998, it wasn't worldwide. It was always like what your IP address sort of slotted you in. And the search engines also do not go out and search. The search is already done when you ask your question, and then they just give you back what they have found before and pre-ordered for you. So. I was quite surprised. I realized that when I wrote the Sign and Revolution, I'm like, whoops.
Yeah.
And that's true until now. And I think, yeah, a lot of people don't realize it that much.
I'm also curious. So when we started talking about the data collection part, and you mentioned this element of how AI models learn language and how humans learn language, or my interpretation of that was, I guess it's a fundamental different way of like how a human learns a language or its first language when we look at children, which is, I think, by imitation, by pattern recognition, by lots of functions of the brain that I don't know about, maybe some do, but like the way you described AI models is that it's based on mathematics, which is a learned language, human-made language in a way that translates things. So I'm curious, once we get there, it has huge implications, I think, on what language is right now, how it's changing through these models. Yeah, and I'm curious what you think about that, because I think it's something you're currently researching.
Yeah, I find it quite fascinating. So if you observe how, when the model learns, first it creates sentences that look like language, but actually they make no sense. Like the words, it looks like you are, okay, this might be a noun, this might be a verb, but it doesn't make any sense. Then words appear that do make sense, but they don't really make a syntactical correct sentence. And then slowly it learns to create a sentence. And it always imitates the style you start writing in. And the fact that ChatGPT answers a question or, you know, goes out and searches the web or whatever, that's done much later. So we have two phases. The one is like 6 month foundational learning. They learn languages. And they learn languages very different if you show a kid, you know, like, this is a window, then that's enough, you know. It, you can then show it another window over there and it goes, window? A machine would be, okay, don't know what that is. So it, one thing, it can't do abstractions. It doesn't understand abstract form or concept of something unless it has seen something 1,000 times or more.
Yeah.
So it's very different in the learning. And it's a statistical learning in parts. And that's also quite interesting, you know, like we learn a lot about language when we look at it. We learn a lot about human language. But I'm quite surprised that companies insist very much we should treat it like normal human language. So they don't warn you so much anymore. Oh, this is a chatbot or this is not. And I find, of course, companies are not interested in warning you about this is actually machine language.
Yes.
Because they don't want you to think about it and don't want you to feel weird. But it's actually, I think it's wrong because machines make very typical mistakes. And if you would know that this is machine generated, you could look out for those mistakes. Like they switch things that are close by around, their facts are maybe a bit wobbly. If you're a student, don't use it for, you know, writing references. They might have the right author, but then the wrong title, and they switch stuff around a little, particularly stuff they've never seen.
Yeah.
And that's also, you know, something we should keep in mind. Yeah. What happens with stuff?
It's just, what happens
that's
with stuff?
Not being seen a lot, you know, that sort of vanishes.
I mean, I think if this tool that you just described was just a tool, then we could treat it as such and be like, well, sometimes it helps, sometimes it doesn't. I think the reality we see right now is that because they seem so good at what they're doing, a lot of the stuff that gets written now is already written by the machine. So the machine gets trained by the machine based on language and meaning making that was already, you know, comes from a completely different end than the human meaning making and language. So where does this get us?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, nowadays they search the web a lot, like you can send them out. So they're not just regurgitating their own knowledge, even though some of it is so-called synthetic data. And we know that it can create model collapse and everybody gets really excited. And there's again...
And model collapse is what exactly? Like a model just can't...
The model just learns... it sort of learns more and more in its own distributions and then it becomes really, it can't generalize very good anymore. So what we want is we feed the model some data, but we want it to, then you can send it out in the world and it would make sense of any data that comes in. If it's just trained on a certain distribution of data, it collapses and doesn't work anymore. It won't be able to go out in the world. And so. So, but there's again this thing that you mentioned earlier, where humans get really excited about model collapse because we're like, oh, at least it needs the human for training. So that is the thought about the excitements, like it can't just train on itself. If you look really very precisely when model collapse happens and when it doesn't happen, synthetic data doesn't guarantee model collapse. It's quite fine to, you know, if the data is varied enough, it's quite okay to be trained on synthetic data.
Okay.
And synthetic data is also a hope for, you know, that you don't need privacy data. You can switch data around and then you can train a model in areas that are sensitive by privacy.
I want to go back to the beginning when we talked about narratives.
Yeah.
Because I feel like, as I mentioned, we often because we're scared of the machines or we don't completely understand how they work, we, as a reaction, as a coping mechanism, we try to understand what makes us truly human. I feel like in 2025, there's a whole huge societal global quest of people trying to understand if an AI can do that, it can generate images, it can generate text, it can write essays that I used to be get paid before. Mm. If it can do that, what am I supposed to do?
Mm-hmm.
So who am I as a human if a machine can replicate what I'm doing? So I'm curious, do you think that narrative is something that's new, or has it always been there when new technologies come along? And what should we do with it? Should we be seriously concerned that AIs are replacing humans in many ways?
I think that's a multi-layered question.
Let's untangle it.
I think in a philosophical way,
mm-hmm.
actually it doesn't matter so much, because I think what is being human has always changed over centuries mm-hmm. and over cultures. You know, you can plop me in the Brazilian jungle and I as a human would be eaten within a second because I don't know what to do. Well, because the intelligence that I have here at King's College London is mm-hmm. absolutely useless in mm-hmm. the Brazilian jungle. So my humanness that makes me, you know, getting okay paid here mm-hmm. would be totally useless,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
So what is human is sort of changes also if we think about 400 years back. I would also be not that good of a human woman,
mm-hmm.
don't have children,
mm-hmm.
it's not so good. So, you know, these values change totally. Middle class. So I think at the same time, that's one layer. So I think philosophically, we learn to live over centuries and over cultures with shifts, and we need to become more, you know, trust ourselves more, that
mm-hmm.
We find a balance in between those different ways of being human and could be more curious about them.
Mm-hmm.
But on the question of what happens to the work and how do we pay people, I mean, the first thing is we try to link the worry about work back to AI, when I think the truth is what's really out of bounds is the financial system. AI threatening work finally gives us something where we could, you know, pour our fear into if there is a future where, you know, there are some really well-paid oligarchs like Peter Thiel or Elon Musk that have... could send their lawyers everywhere while you can't afford the same lawyer to defend yourself. Mm. And then also the question of, well, now intellectual work is being automated. We see it already being automated in parts and it can get automated. And of course, you know, the stuff I teach, I could teach, an AI could teach that.
Yeah.
But my students wouldn't pay attention
because
there's a certain politeness in having a human in front of class and they can't just, you know, start doing something else, yawn around, stand up, go to the loo, whatever, you know, they must pay attention. They're in a classroom, everyone else around them behaves in the same way, and that's like an attention mechanism, the classroom where someone stands and holds the attention of 100 people and enforces a certain behavior, and this is the situation and we have agreed upon that's what you should behave. And an AI can't replace that. I mean, we can now survey people and say, you didn't pay attention, you only read the first two pages. But still, you know, it's no joy. So I think,
But however, I would argue that the logic in the out of bounds financial system that you described is often, well, the AI can do what you can do, which we just mentioned. Let's replace it. Let's not pay a human anymore to do that. So that's actually happening, not so much in universities, but in lots of different sectors.
Yeah. I think it will. I mean, as soon as we have the next, someone said that and I thought it makes much sense. Like, when will the AI come? And someone said it will come with the next financial crisis, because then companies, you know, they need to slim down and they don't need to excuse themselves why AI is doing stuff. So I think that will happen. But yeah, and then that's where I think, again, we need a regulation. We need an idea, what do we do with people? How do we, you know, reorganize that? I mean, we're sitting here in Britain. the Thatcher years in the 1980s created a mass unemployment, mining strikes, and so on and so on, strikes at newspapers, thousands and thousands of people are unemployed without a job. And we, you know, we are sure, why should we save money and do something for the economy if what we're doing for the economy is not for the people? And that question is a bit out of bounds, because at the moment the discussion and the thought that we have is always still, oh, if we do something for the economy, it will automatically trickle down for the people.
Right, and that equation doesn't work anymore in the age of AI.
And I'm not sure who's bold enough as a politician to tell anyone, you know, or what kind of revolution it needs. But yeah, it needs not a silent revolution.
I mean, I had this thought the other day, because talking about narratives and talking about hype cycles and narratives that are being promoted by tech companies or economic actors, I think if we look back 5 years ago when the pandemic happened, suddenly the narrative was all about remote work. Everything is going to go remote. We see that it works. Companies don't need offices anymore. So over the last years, many of the biggest companies in the world switched to remote work and wanted to have a remote friendly environment, until suddenly, I think last year, the first big company said, well, actually, we want people back in the office, because we realized it's not that great.
Yeah.
People collaborate better in person. Yeah. Coming back to the argument that you mentioned, where you as a person teaching other humans, there is a different sense of attention, there's a different sense of policy, politeness, and so on. So we discovered these human elements that essentially can't be replaced. But weirdly, we trust technology so much and we trust these hype cycles so much that the narrative often is, if you don't do it, you're going to lose.
Yeah.
So you don't have time to think. You don't have time to reconsider. You got to act now. Otherwise, you're going to lose out.
Yeah, it's a bit of a problem. I'm always surprised because, you know, the COVID years, they vanish so massively. I mean, sometimes you can see like archaeological findings, those stickers, it's like wash your hands somewhere lurking, but we also forgot about them. It's like they didn't happen,
right?
And at the same time, they show to us humans that if we must, we can actually change. It's also, you know, in a positive way, you can see societies can change tremendously, and I think we need that change, but no one's, it's sort of slowly coming, but it's not really there yet in a way that, you know, people are ready for it in really what it means. And I'm a bit worried that the AI fear and the AI concern and hatred is a bit like what Marx wrote about religion, is the opium of the people. And now we just hate AI instead of we really hate the capitalistic system.
Right.
You know, just the AI is shit, but let the rest stay as it is.
Yeah.
And that really worries me a bit.
On our final note, I want to end with something optimistic,
I
think, you know, in this podcast, we talk a lot to artists and creatives about how they use technology. And my impression of the work you've done with Serpentine, with the Creative AI Lab, is something that goes in that direction, where you build up a database of resources and material, experiments by artists, writings, that I think aims to guide artists and creatives in their use of generative AI or AI models in general. So can you talk a little bit about that project, how it came about, and what its impact was so far?
Yeah, we were from the start, we are a bit odd, because I think Eva Jäger from Serpentine Gallery and me, we were never really worried about, oh, what will happen to contemporary art now that there is AI. We were more like, oh, great, that's an interesting challenge. So first of all, we wanted to help artists to work with AI and make it more accessible. So that's what the data set online was about. It was like commenting and sort of giving a bit of feedback about which tools are good. And then we became more and more interested in how do artists work with the back end of AI and how do they work differently with it? So why, when corporations all have a certain perspective on AI, and how do artists do that differently? And The interesting thing is, I mean, I think it's a bit different if you talk to illustrators than to fine artists. Fine artists are not under threat through AI, you know, they love tools. We, in the history of art, we always had automation. We always had, these kind of systems thinking, being tested and incorporated in serial production. So fine art's not so threatened by AI. But fine art, there are many artists that they get their head more and more into technology and around technology and use it to different means and also are interested in different moments of the technology. And I think that was a bit where the Creative AI Lab was sitting, was like to not be against the technology, but to make more visible that artists are actually using AI different. And of course, you could think of Holly Hand and Matt Dryhurst, but also many other people. There's a group called Demystification that sit next to us in Somerset House, have their studio there. There are many different artists that sort of more work with AI, but approach it not to optimize the systems. Sometimes they approach it like Alison Parrish with like linguistic poetry in a weird way to create work. Sometimes they work more around the ecosystem of AI, so it's really a wide field.
So you'd say it encourages artists to create their own narratives and to use AI as a tool on their own terms to enhance and to experiment with these technologies.
Yeah, and I think the difference is that, you know, when you are a company, you create AI for a certain use case and you are naturally have a solution in your mind. So if the AI doesn't do what you want it to do, you know, for an artist, that's a poetic moment. It's like, oh, this is interesting. Why is this happening? Let's work with this. While the companies are more like, oh, you know, like, how can we shut this down? So that's, it's a different mindset of working with a tool and also allowing the tool to be more multifaceted. And I think, because we talked about AI literacy, I think art galleries and museums are also a really, really important public sphere now, because where do you meet AI apart from the chatbot in your internet that goes on your nerves? You know, where can you like try it out and understand how it works? Who explains the mechanisms to you? And I think a lot of artists' work does that.
So I see in on the shelf just on your head the publication Why Technology Needs Artists, which I read, which is something I think you participated in. And I guess that's precisely the answer to use technology differently with different ends in mind. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, totally. I think, and I think it's also really important that I'm a bit worried that the critique of technology, as important as it is, leads to technology just being used by idiots that want to get rich fast, instead of being developed by people that are critical, you know, that are, that want a different society. So we are a bit, with all our hatred for AI, we are a bit also cutting interesting people off the technology, and we need more people that generally think critical, that work with technology, instead of giving them the idea of please do not work with AI, it's really not okay.
Amen. Hallelujah. I think that's the best way to end the conversation.
All right.
Thank you so much.